This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. All right, you've heard me talk about BetterHelp for a long time, but I don't know that we've actually ever talked about how much people really love this service when they use it. But good news, you don't have to take my word for it. In fact, if you go to betterhelp.com/reviews, you can see countless amazing customer reviews in real time. And they constantly update these reviews like every day, and sometimes like literally hundreds of people saying how much they love BetterHelp and how helpful it's been to them. So again, just hop over to betterhelp.com/reviews to see for yourself. And if you need another reminder, let me remind you that more than 6 million people have used BetterHelp globally. And because they have that consistent feedback from real users, it makes it really easy to see why so many people continue to choose BetterHelp. And if those reviews aren't enough for you, well, BetterHelp makes it really easy to get started. All you got to do is go to betterhelp.com, answer a few questions, and they will match you with a therapist based on your answers and your needs. And here's the other thing. If it's not working out for some weird reason, you can switch therapists at any time. Again, any time if it's not the right fit. So see it for yourself. Go see the reviews, see what stands out, and see if BetterHelp is right for you. Visit betterhelp.com. That's betterhelp.com.
All right. Welcome back.
Thank you.
To another episode of Screensaver on Friends from Work Plus. It has been a bit since we've done one of these. I guess we talked Widow's Bay not long ago.
Yeah.
But
And I called the Nolan film ranking technically Screensaver.
Oh, yeah, so. Yeah, true, true. Which if you are listening to this and have not listened to that, that's not something you need to listen to before this conversation, but it is a good companion piece. Because today we are talking about The Odyssey, Christopher Nolan's newest film that is blowing up everywhere and making people lose their minds. So I have talked to you a little bit. We talked about this after I saw it, before you saw it. And then you and I talked a little bit after you saw it. Before we get into The Odyssey itself and the meat of it, I just wanted to say, I always like to note generally positive developments in the world, especially in the age of the kind of AI slop and all of the anxiety around what happens with the arts as things are being increasingly flattened out. In that way, I have been so encouraged by the response to The Odyssey. Not that I was shocked. I mean, like we've said before, Christopher Nolan has a very, very high floor. And I don't think anyone has ever walked out of a Christopher Nolan movie thinking that it was poorly made. So
for sure.
I knew that that was not going to be the case. But, you know, it sort of reminds me of Sinners, where there was a lot of talk about how expensive it was, how much trouble they went to do all this stuff on location and to do all of it practically. And you could imagine that if this movie did not pan out and was not a commercial hit, even if it was a critical one, then that would give a lot of studios an excuse to say, well, yeah, that's why we can't do that stuff. We can't afford to do that. The economy is changing around this stuff. We have to tighten the budgets. And instead, like we've talked about a little bit, you hear Tom Holland saying that he carried over stuff that he saw Nolan do on The Odyssey to Brand New Day. And so that then shows, okay, well, now we've seen it works in The Odyssey. Everything we've seen about Brand New Day in terms of the promo stuff and the trailers, it looks incredible. So I get the sense that it's gonna work there in the superhero context. And I think, to me, that's encouraging for two reasons. One, I think it's so important for people to be interested in, like for audiences to be interested in a particular creator's vision when it comes to a movie and be interested in a human touch, like on the story level, but also on the execution and the cinematography and the location stuff that you've always talked about. Some of the same things that I still think make Lord of the Rings hold up so well when you read about what they did to make that happen and the location scouting they did for that in New Zealand. So there's that piece that I think in the AI era is the thing that will separate art from content. But then the second piece of that is just as it pertains to Marvel and this ongoing conversation that we've been having for 3-4 years now about the kind of the VFX output or the potential issues with the stress that's put on these VFX studios or Marvel's over-reliance and why they have to not go on location because of budget and all this stuff. I think not just for Marvel, but because that's our primary lens here, if that can then be brought to Brand New Day and it does work well there, then I think that that could be a continuation of all of the stuff that we've seen that we've liked so much about the last few projects as they've been edging towards building out an entire Fantastic Four set or doing these crazy stunts for Thunderbolts practically and having Florence Pugh jump off the top of a building. Like, I think that stuff there, again, because like Thunderbolts is a movie that we thought was incredible, was made that way. Not enough people saw it. And so there's always a little fear that, okay, well, like that stuff probably took additional time and money and maybe it wasn't worth it. So I don't know. This is all like my very long intro rant way of saying I loved this movie for what it is, but I'm also so grateful for this movie for what I think it can do to the film industry at large in 2026.
Yeah, I love that you started there. I actually posted a video on social media just the other day about how it's so fun to think things are cool again. Mm. Like, it feels like that era of overwhelming negativity was a few years ago, and that it feels like we're kind of exiting that a little bit. And I think the movie theater at large experience kind of returning is another good sign. Because everything you just said about The Odyssey, I could argue also probably applied to Project Hail Mary earlier this year.
Like,
they spent the kind of money. There's all the practical effects, you know, apparently, you know, famously no CGI or whatever.
Right.
And then it got rewarded by being a really popular movie. And I think it's important that you point that out, not just the critical response, because yes, Thunderbolts had the critical response, but also the box office response. But I also think you sent an article just the other day to me. Yeah, I think the audience is telling us stuff, because I don't think the era of franchises or IP is dead, because, you know, Spider-Man and Doomsday are going to be probably the two biggest movies of the year financially. Yeah. Spider-Man is now trending towards $750 million opening weekend, which is the only movie that I can remember was Avengers Endgame got $1 billion in the first weekend, which if you think about that is absolutely insane.
Wild.
But the fact that this movie is getting even close to that and will surpass No Way Home, now we'll see how good it is and like if it has legs on the back end. But there is still space for that. Toy Story 5 absolutely crushed. So there is still space for IP. But I do think that, yeah, the audiences are rewarding films like Project Hail Mary, Sheep Detectives, a movie like this, The Odyssey.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. And Obsession, Backrooms, like two other examples of very practically driven.
Have you watched those yet?
No.
Candace and I have slowly been getting caught up on movies and watched those last week. But
what was it worth the hype? 10 seconds?
I think so. I think both are kind of in the horror genre,
for sure.
Which I know is not as it's more our thing than your thing. But yeah, I mean, I think both were, they're so different, but we thought they were both pretty incredible.
Okay. So it's just, that's been fun. And I'm also with you. The Odyssey is kind of the pinnacle of all that, per your point. It's not just a little bit of that. It's like, no, they went to 6 different locations. Like everything is filmed on location. And you know, I've been beating that drum forever. That's the one thing I want Marvel to change, even with Doomsday. And I think what they would argue is not necessarily even the budget. One, it's that these places aren't real. Because even The Odyssey is based on a real location.
Right.
Right. Whereas like, you know, a make-believe planet or inside of a spaceship is not the exact same. And two, I think Marvel is always concerned of spoilers. Like, Spider-Man could have been shot in downtown New York, but the logistical nightmare of trying to pull off things that surprise people is really hard. So I get the sense that they go overseas to film like kind of the generic action sequences, but the other stuff is still going to be in unbelievable sets. No matter how unbelievable the sets are, though, there is something fun about some of those shots you get in the Odyssey of Matt Damon walking by himself on the beach, a totally empty beach that's as far as the eye can see. You just can't recreate that with CGI. That's been my argument the whole time. Them going into the cave and even recording the dialogue in the cave is not the same as putting a reverb of cave reverb on the vocal. It's actually in the cave. And there is something about that. Now, I realize that's not always possible, but I think that'd be their pushback. It is still the one thing I hope that Marvel picks up and does even more of. Like, let's keep going that direction. So I hope, like you said, that the lesson from Thunderbolts is not, oh man, this didn't work. We need movies like The Odyssey to remind them. No, let's keep going further. Like, the more effort you put into this, and I think it's, like you said, I'm just reiterating everything you just said, but it's more important the more that AI becomes a thing. Yeah. The more and more that becomes a thing, even with like this podcast, people are more and more attuned to, oh, I want something that's authentic or natural or human.
Yeah.
The more that becomes a thing. I think it is worth celebrating. By the way, I also want to ask one last thing. Yeah. Politically, I also think it's worth celebrating, and we don't get political on this podcast.
Yeah.
But like the crazy, weird, tiny, tiny movement of boycotting the movie and because it was too woke and all this stuff, which is such a strange movie to pick.
Yeah.
I can't help but celebrate the fact, hence my social media video, that stuff is such a small population. Like, this is such a huge reminder. There are still 70mm showings that are still sold out to this day, weeks later.
Yeah.
So the non-boycotted bros won. And that to me feels like an important celebration too, because it's so easy. Like, I even have listeners that are talking about this. It's so easy to get your, for whatever reason, your feed on social media curated to hate. Like, even people who hate on the Avengers Doomsday trailer, if you click on one of them, it starts showing you all of them. And you start thinking, nobody likes this trailer.
Right.
That's what is easy, because that's all you see. And then, like, I posted a video about how excited I am about the Avengers Doomsday trailer.
Yeah.
And someone on Thread said, wow, this is really refreshing because my entire feed, for some reason, is negative about it, and I have no idea why.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. You got to remember, it's still selling out like crazy.
I know.
It's like 1%.
But I was thinking like the same thing.
It's like your feed gets curated for that. So when people were hating on The Odyssey, it's like 0.1%. And this is just a reminder, the internet is not real life. That's not what the world is like. That's what the internet's like.
I think I think of those as so similar because there was this immediate, it's almost like people were just waiting for the trailer to drop to scream from the mountaintops, I'm so over Marvel, like, which is whatever, like, it's fine. But it's almost like, it's like the like, I remember I had a philosophy professor in college that was an avowed atheist, and he always joked that there are like two generations of atheists, and that he was a first generation atheist, because the first generation, you don't believe in God, but you're still mad at him for not existing. And then the second generation, you just don't believe in God, but it's like that transition mode that I always thought was kind of funny. And he recognized the paradox there of having anger at something that you
claim doesn't exist.
Right. And I feel like there are these people that are like, they don't care about Marvel.
They'll say, I don't care, I don't follow it, I'm not watching it, but they're so loud about it.
Yeah, why are you commenting on this? That, why did you watch the trailer? Why did you come here and start talking about it?
Because you do care about it still. You do care about it still. That's the funny thing.
It's just I thought the same thing. It's so...
But I actually think conversely, the opposite is literally true. It's not even just that it's neutral. It's that for the first time in probably since No Way Home, I had people like Nate and Seth start a group text going, oh my gosh, the Doomsday trailer.
Yeah.
And I had a couple, Peter texted me, Kyle. My wife called me from work at like 8:30 in the morning. Emergency. Have you seen it? Right? My point is these are not conversations I'm having regularly. So my point is the opposite. The regulars are going to be back in. It's only the people who spent so much time reading the description of the trailer that are mad there's nothing new. But if you had never heard that there's a description, you'd be losing your mind.
It's like what we talked about in our reaction there. And I'm not making this a doomsday conversation, but it's the people that have been keyed into this the most are the ones that have the least kind of surprised delight by the trailer, which is understandable because, like we said, I think you're right. It's a reminder that like that trailer was made for general audiences to get people like introduced to what's going on, to get people excited about it. And I think you step back from all of it and it's just like at the end of the day, people want to go to a theater and feel something and be a part of this kind of communal experience and also be really invested in a story. And The Odyssey does that in such a unique way. And Avengers Doomsday can do that in a totally different way.
You just don't want the fandom to become a toxic Star Wars fandom because you just don't want people to get so into the weeds and the details of every single thing. And you start losing some patience. You have a lack of patience for like the next development. The lack of surprise and curiosity gets taken away. And I just don't want it to become a thing where now you feel this ownership over it. And then therefore like an anger and an hatred towards a project that is actually like the irony of the whole thing is it's your dream that they're doing this, right? Like it's your dream that you finally get to see Dr. Doom, but you've gotten so invested that now you're mad it's not this one thing or the accent's off, or it's like just back up a little bit and take it for what it's worth. And remember, like you said, that there's also the casual audience that we want along for this ride too.
And that's why
same thing with like the Odyssey. Like don't it's literally a fictional work. So to make an AI movie that's historically accurate doesn't make sense. It's not historical.
Yeah. I mean,
let's just not go that far, everybody.
I think the thing about the Odyssey to get into that is.
Yeah, let's talk about the movie.
Nolan has done such a good job through his entire career of having, and I think part of this is because he is famously pretty unplugged and as analog as he can be, you know, being
no phone.
A superstar director.
No email.
Like, it's like he's plugged in enough to know who is working in Hollywood that he wants to work with. He clearly watches a ton of movies and stuff. He's plugged in that way. But, which by the way, I didn't realize that he and Coogler go back as far as they do. I was like, you know, reading an interview with him where he talked about taking Ryan Coogler to see an IMAX screening of Dunkirk.
That's so cool. You know what else is so cool about him? Not only is he removed from that and he's still in touch, it's like the perfect balance because he's also a fan of stuff.
Yeah.
Like he's like a closeted Fast and the Furious fan.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
he has praised Spider-Man and he's
Star
praised
Wars.
Marvel and he's praised Star Wars and he's praised Toy Story. So it's like, it's not like he's, it's like the perfect storm.
It's not he's like a, the
he's like a genius
he,
making
like
these.
I have
yeah,
to
exactly.
Be above it. Yeah,
right. It's he's into it. He's making the best movies in the world, but then he's also into this stuff. It's like, and he's disconnected.
And
from the internet.
I think because of that, he has. I think this is the most challenge. I would imagine the most challenging thing to do as a high profile creator, and I think the most important thing. It makes me think of like Pluribus, right? Like the she is so valuable in the world because she is the only one. It's not that her books are even that good. It's just that they are at least her books. Like they are a story that is not just like a collective creation. And so I think if you start to lose that, if you start to lose whatever your own perspective as a creator is, then at some point it just doesn't even really matter. Like, what are we, what's the point now? Like, if you are just giving back to me what I'm demanding of you, then now right. there's no point in me even watching your movie because you're just, you're
then just literally giving, you have AI. You
yeah. could, like I gave you a AI prompt to give me back my content.
That's right.
And that's like,
I go to the movies to be surprised.
Right.
That's why I'm going.
And
I
all
don't
through,
want to know. And then learning it is the coolest thing ever. And then reflecting on, do you remember that time you learned yeah. this new detail?
And that's the ups the fun and of downs it. And swerves of the last 10 years in terms of the politics of it and the culture of it and the film industry and the way we interact with that. Nolan has been pretty consistent in the way he approaches these movies and what he values and whether it's worked kind of or worked really, really well. I feel like you've never seen a project from him that feels like a reaction to something.
That's
and
right.
I think that's really important, especially as we're talking about some of the controversy around this movie or the purported controversy around this movie.
All right. That was an awesome 20 minutes. I'm going to now get us into some details. My experience with The Odyssey was very similar to Parasite in that I left the theater thinking that was really good. I got to experience it in an elevated cinema experience with my father, which was really special. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've ever gone to a rated R movie with my dad.
Oh, nice.
And he liked it way more than he thought. He thought he was going to like it because he likes Nolan, but he liked it way more. And other than the other mommy trailer that played right beforehand, holy cow, my dad and I were totally scarred. Did you have that mama trailer? You saw a screener.
Yeah, we didn't have any trailers.
Dude, it's
I actually
the most
haven't
horrific
seen that trailer yet.
They play a horrific horror trailer right before the movie. It's like making memes online. I'm serious. Like, because people were like, what the heck is this trailer right beforehand? It's Jessica Chastain. Anyways, he had a great experience. I really liked it. I think when I messaged you like minutes after, because you guys were bothering me, you and Pete, like, oh, Kyle hates The Odyssey because he's not saying anything. I was processing it with my dad. I was like a 7.5 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then like literally in the parking lot, this happened with Josh Wilson and Parasite. We started talking about the deeper messages of it. And we started talking about like, oh yeah, the ending with Athena, the statue getting their head cut off. And as
right.
the statue's head cut off, you see Zendaya's head cut off. And then you realize, oh, he's just picturing Athena that way as a representation of his guilt.
Yeah.
I have chills right now. And I started processing it all and I realized, oh, this is a masterpiece.
Yeah.
I liked it, but no, this is a masterpiece.
And
then
my dad
who has read The Odyssey to go on some tangents about like the fact that they added this like guilt complex about
right.
it and like the state of the world. And then he was excited about the spiritual aspect. Not that it's not overtly Christian, but this
right.
idea that like, you know, you take care of other people.
Yeah. It's
and,
about
and because
civility.
He didn't, he felt guilt and that like civilization was falling apart because they were no longer taking care of other
like
people.
Like he cracked the foundation and yeah, I,
and that scene of him, like it was so genius. This is what Nolan's so good at. Oh, I saw the meme from the other guys. Remember when the other guys, and they're like, tell us the story. And he's like,
yeah,
he's like, well, I think it'd be better to start at the end and occasionally return with flashbacks. He goes with this whole thing. They're like,
right.
dude, just tell us the story, man. But people have been using that meme for Christopher Nolan and all his movies.
Yeah.
But it is genius that even this story wasn't totally linear. It's my favorite thing about Christopher Nolan.
Although I have to say, The Odyssey poem is not linear either. What's funny
okay.
is it's largely told in it picks up basically with him leaving Calypso's Island and Telemachus going to figure out where he is, and then most of the famous episodes from The Odyssey are told in flashbacks. So it was well suited to Nolan's storytelling style.
My point is, I went into The Odyssey thinking my takeaway to kick off a podcast episode with you would be the visuals and the acting and look at the practical effects, and all those things are true. But the thing that I can't stop thinking about 2 weeks later, a week and a half later, the thing that is just haunting me is those other themes. The fact that he kept returning to that shot of Matt Damon on the stairs and you never know what it is. And then as the movie goes along, you see a little bit more until the final reveal where he's walking through Troy, just like devastated at what's happening. And just like Oppenheimer, in some ways feels like a sequel, this realization of, oh no, what have I done? Because it was his idea for the horse, just like Oppenheimer. It was his idea.
Right.
And then he got in there and saw the execution of it and thought, this is horrific. So to add that as an element, instead of it just being, hey, the gods are trying to spite him on the way home. It's like, no, he's also carrying such a guilt that he doesn't even feel like he can go home, that he is himself. I don't know, man. That's the part where I'm like, okay, this is now on my list of best movies I've ever seen, you know, that we've talked about before.
I think when I first texted you my thoughts, I think I said almost the exact same thing, and that like the soundtrack's incredible, visuals are incredible, Matt Damon's incredible, all the performances are, but it's the way he reframes the fall of Troy that makes it into a masterpiece, because and that's what I meant with him having something to say. Like, there's a version of that movie where someone picks up the Odyssey and has all of Nolan's filmmaking prowess and just says, I am going to make an incredible, very accurate adaptation of this and cast it the same and do everything from an execution perspective in the same way, and you come out with just a really, really great Odyssey adaptation. But I think that Nolan did, like with Oppenheimer, find his own take on this. And he, you know, like you read through the Odyssey and like the Emily Wilson translation that he used for the script. And I mean, it's interesting, like in her introduction to it, it's interesting that there's so little like editorializing within it, or you're not really told exactly how to feel about Odysseus other than the fact that the narration is always kind of pointing to how clever he is and how cunning he is and just how he lies constantly, but he's the hero. Like you're supposed to root for him, but it's also this thing where he clearly does these things. And you're like, why are you doing this? Like, and it is a little bit like Oppenheimer, like in those scenes where he's kind of being so cavalier about his communist associations and the people around him.
Relationships.
They're like, man, you have to be careful. And he's like, why? You know, like, I'm so important. What are they going to do to me? And here it's worse than that, because it's not just what are they going to do to me. It's like with the Cyclops, like he taunts him and gets more of his men killed. And there's no reason why he needs to do it. And in the poem, it's an even bigger mistake, because it actually does invoke the wrath of Poseidon, which is another thing that you pointed out that I love that Nolan did here. I was so curious going into this movie to see how he was going to do the gods. Because in the poem, the gods are very much actual characters. In the poem, they're doing things, they talk to him, there's no ambiguity there. But I always thought that would be a big swing for Nolan. You know, it's one thing to do the Cyclops and all of that stuff as kind of creatures, but to do, okay, here he is talking to Hermes, you know, here's a meeting between Zeus and Poseidon talking about Odysseus, would just always seem like an odd Nolan move. And the way he did it, to where everyone talks about the gods, worships the gods, treats the gods as real, but it's sort of left to the audience to decide whether there really is, like, whether this stuff is all from the gods, or as you were saying, whether really a lot of this stuff, a lot of Odysseus doing the things that are, that you want him not to do, like the don't just take the way everybody else is taking, like don't provoke people unnecessarily, just like listen to your men. You start to think, oh no, like maybe even if he wasn't aware of it, maybe this is all this gigantic act of self-sabotage, like self-flagellation, because he doesn't think that he deserves to get home. And maybe he shouldn't be bringing his own men down with him. But it's this idea, like, it's also not just him, right? Like, the people he's with, he has let them pillage Troy. He's watched them now pillage other cities that they're coming back, like along the coast. And at the end, you realize now what he's seeing play out and how much he is now feeling a personal responsibility as the one guy that everybody associates as the hero of Troy, because he came up with this idea and he was the one that executed it all. He's now realizing not only that it was this savage act of going in and murdering all these people essentially in their sleep, but also the fact that he does it all through a trick that is rooted in
a gift
to Athena, like a gift to the gods, which they then take only because they say, well, we worship the same gods. We should bring this to our temple. And so it's not just a trick. It's that he is taking advantage of people's beliefs and their trust that nobody would use something as sacred as that to deceive them. So it's just like you see, it's this stuff that maybe you could read it in to the Odyssey poem, but what he pulled out of that, I think, makes the whole narrative so powerful, especially in 2026, and not because of any particular political issue, but because there is no denying that we have had a fundamental breakdown in our ability to relate to each other over the last 15 years. And I don't think that is a controversial statement at all. And I think that there has been this crack in the foundation of, like, not to be overdramatic, but the human experience, in that people no longer look for that. Like, people don't look for shared experience. They look for areas of disconnect and disagreement and like almost look for opportunities to be engaged in conflict. And I think that the way that Nolan is reframing this ancient poem to feel still timeless, but also very, very relevant, I thought was powerful on its own, and such a powerful response to the people that tried to make this some kind of, again, another component of the woke, anti-woke, whatever internet argument.
That is so well said. I don't know what to follow up. I don't even know that. Like, that felt so important. Well said. It feels so trivial now to talk about little things in the movie, but that was unbelievable.
But there are so many little things in the movie that were also
incredible.
I know,
but that's the message I want people to hear. Robbie's last 7 minutes, go back, rewind, listen to that again, play it to yourself over and over. I do think as a culture, it really matters. And yeah, we're probably overstating it because it's a movie, but it is just a sliver, like a little peek into what I think culture is like. I will say about the book translation in Odysseus, like, you know, taunting the Cyclops, I like that in this movie, the order of those events matter. Like, I think you see Odysseus change as it goes along. Now, I'm not sure if he does that in the poem, but like the Cyclops thing is the, like, so they first pillage one town,
mm-hmm.
where it's like burning right away after. Then he taunts the Cyclops as totally unnecessary. But then as he goes along, like, he starts changing how he views, like, Cersei, for example. Like, he kind of shows her grace. And then by the time it's like he goes to Hades, he really has, I think, a genuine concern for his men that maybe he didn't have during the Cyclops era. And then, like, when they have to go by the whirlpool and the monster or whatever, he's super bummed about losing the 6 people. He wants to find a way to save them all. He's the one that stays tied to the pole of the ship during the siren. So, like, meaning, I do think he shows his character changing along the way, the longer he sits with that regret. And I like that for the movie. Again, don't know how that relates to the poem, but.
No, I think the way he, the sequencing is generally the same, but I think the way that Matt Damon approaches it and the specific way it's scripted here highlights what you're pointing out. There were also some, there were some moments, and I'm trying to think, there were things he condensed from an, you know, again, talking about the adaptation piece, things that he kind of merged together. And I think that was generally smart, because it kind of helped what you're saying. I mean, like when you read the poem, it, again, it was an oral thing that was handed down, and it's unknown how many changes it went through or whatever, but you read it and it feels fairly disjointed because it's kind of a rambling story and there are tangents and stuff. And I think that was another thing that he did really effectively to mark out an actual trajectory. Like even the book, you don't, he's telling the story to largely to another group of people that like he's sent to after leaving Calypso's Island, and he tells them the whole story. They give him a ship. Then he goes to Ithaca. Then all of that, the whole last chunk kind of happens. But here he just he takes away that whole portion of the story, which I think is a smart move, and has, instead of Matt Damon telling all of that to these random people, he's remembering it as and telling Calypso as it's coming back. And then he's kind of processing it with her. So yeah, I think he does do some really clever things with the sequencing. Oh, the other thing I was going to point out about the Athena piece is in the book, Athena is consistently with him and praising him and loves how kind of wily he is. But I thought this was, like you hinted at early on, the Zendaya move was, you know, the powerful.
It's like the crux of the whole story. Yeah, even though she's hardly in it.
Yeah.
But for that to be, I guess the big reveal, the twist of the whole story is that, essentially.
Yeah.
That's almost like her ghost that he's haunted by because of that guilt. Can we talk briefly about the people of the sea?
Yeah, did you take that to be Odysseus's men?
So, a lot of people commented that if you watch it a second time, it's even cooler, because that's one example of something that once you kind of know that it is Odysseus's men, which I think is the case. Now, again, I just watched it one time, 10 days ago. But I think that's the point, is people are starting to hear rumors, right, of this terrible people that are doing awful things. And I think he starts realizing, oh, crap, that's me they're talking about.
Yeah.
Is that right?
I think so.
if you know that, then I think there's another layer of guilt as you're going through it.
Because the at first I thought they were talking about the Phaeacians are the people that Odysseus washes up on their shore in the poem, and they are known as people with the shipbuilders, they're sea people. So that's what I thought at first as the movie was starting, but then you never hear anything else about that. So I think it was almost reminds me of what we've talked about Nolan doing with The Dark Knight, you know, where he kind of makes you think you're getting the Two-Face origin story, and then you don't until an hour later, and he sort of takes advantage of what some people's expectations might be. I kind of think it's that, where if you go in with some familiarity, you're thinking that it's maybe some kind of reference to that. But I feel like it's pretty, because doesn't Penelope have a line where she's
afraid of the people of the sea? Doesn't she say that?
And I think when he says something, she connects that, or seems to. I had a question too.
I definitely need to see it again. Annika still hasn't seen it. I have to go to 70 millimeter here in Nashville because I watched it at a really nice theater, but not 70 millimeter. And I think these are the things you'll pick up on. Sometimes a movie this thick, you know, for 3 hours, there are things that you have to digest and then take it from a different angle. You know, like I there's stuff for sure that I missed.
What was, because this is something else that was expanded on pretty heavily and like Robert Pattinson's Antinous character was really, he's for sure a major villain in the poem, but basically just as the head suitor guy, you don't have the amount of backstory that you get here with him as a kid. And
yeah,
and I was trying to track what exactly was it that he did.
My understanding again, I could be wrong. He's one of those kids that is like draws the straw that has to go to war. And instead he switches it with his younger sibling or whatever, who then has to go to war. And that's who dies as the sacrifice. Elliot, who dies as the sacrifice.
Right.
Cinna, I think, is his brother or something that then dies as the sacrifice. And that's why in Hades, Cinna says, like, make sure my brother knows the shame. Like, he feels the shame.
Okay,
because he switched it. And then he goes back and says that for Cinna when he kills him.
But like, I was just confused about why that was then... why did he talk about Sinnott's father being betrayed in that way?
I gotta watch it again.
I do too.
I thought the betrayal was just that his son lied.
Yeah.
About the chance.
I need to, because there was something, it's like Odysseus was aware of it, I think, at the time, but thought he was doing the right thing. I think he knew that there was a swap, but he thought...
Yeah, I'll watch that again.
Yeah.
The pig stuff was unbelievably gross. My dad and I, that's the only scene I said to Annika, I think that's the one scene where she's going to have a hard time. My dad and I were going, oh!
Yeah,
like, I can't, and they pulled it off practically, apparently. But like, dude, just like, there was something so eerie and weird. You can see why Chris Nolan could do a horror movie, because there was something so off about even just the eating when they couldn't stop.
Yeah.
And it was like, it started getting weird and the music started getting weird. And I'm like, dude, relax, everyone. You're eating so fast. Chill out. And then as she starts massaging their head and like pulling their face out, I was like, this is gross, man. Like,
yeah.
I can't believe they pulled it off. And amazing performance by her. But just like the weirdest thing, I had to point that out. Just so weird. The other thing I have to point out, I saw some memes about this, and I can honestly say I thought this before the memes. This was the loudest movie I've ever been in. I don't know about your theater, but to me, not even close, this is the loudest movie. And the sound that the Cyclops made, that scream after they hit it in the eye, combined with Goranson's music, was like almost dangerously loud. Like it was so loud that I was looking at my dad going like, he has hearing aids. I'm like, turn yours down. This is like, this had to be 115 decibels for that scream.
Yeah.
I could not believe it. I saw a meme that was like, well, one, I saw Kyle Brandt, friend of the pod, tweet about, there's still a sound from the Odyssey that I can't stop thinking about, get out of my head. And it's certainly that. He later clarified that was what he was talking about. So shout out Kyle,
that's
if he's
funny.
Listening. And then I saw another person say, this is the loudest movie. I thought I was going to die on that damn ship right with him. Like, this is like, it was so loud that I thought I was there. Those are two random things. The Cersei thing was gross as all get out. And that sound was crazy.
The thrum. When he strings the bow the first time, which...
How about how loud was it when they surprised the throat stab?
Yeah.
Was like shocking twist because he's in the middle of his sentence. And then when the one guy goes, oh crap, it's Odysseus. Yeah. And he doesn't even finish it and the arrow hits him in the throat.
Yeah.
That was loud too. Like, oh, hello.
Which, you know, another thing that I think he pulled off really well with all that is in the poem... Athena actually physically transforms Odysseus when he comes back so that he is literally unrecognizable.
You can't see it. Okay, yeah.
And I thought that they did a really good job of just giving him the, you know, between the beard and the cloak. And, you know, it's been enough time. Like in the poem, it's as though he hasn't aged. So she just 20 has
years.
To. Yeah. Yeah. But
his son would never know, right?
You
know?
Yeah. I mean.
Which, by the way, isn't that such a great metaphor too? Like you're talking about how he handled the gods and stuff.
Right.
It's so cool to me that he basically made a movie where he's kind of making a stance that those gods aren't necessarily real, but you could see how a telling of that story would grow the legend of the gods, right? Like someone would be like, and then he knew Athena and he would see her all the time.
Yeah.
He would convene with her. Or like she hid his identity from people. But really what he did is he just like cloaked himself.
Yeah.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, it's like a perfect, that's like what the Odyssey is. It's not true, but it's based on like a story, you know?
Yeah. Well, and like historically, if you know, there are all these articles that have come out and I was reading
there are true
on
things
it after
about
the screener. Well, and there are people that at times like worshipped Odysseus after the story started, like the you know, viewed that character as a god.
After the legend grew.
Right. So yeah, it is this kind of this thing that grows in the telling. I also thought John Leguizamo, jeez.
Okay.
Did an incredible job.
Okay, so me too. I thought when I saw him, I didn't know he was in this movie. I thought that's a weird casting. Like that's not who I would ever think.
Right.
Even he himself in interviews has said that. Like I was like, well, what? I'm in a Nolan movie. But I thought by the end, the opposite. Like he stood out to me. I mean, a lot of great performances, but he was really great.
Yeah.
That last sequence when they came and ruined his farm, like that was heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'll say that's another thing. Again, you talk about how in the book, Odysseus is a little more of a gray area character because he's cunning and doing all this stuff that's a little whatever.
Mm-hmm.
This is why it's partially my scene, is Nolan did a good job of, by that ending, you are fully rooting for him. I mean, it's like a badass scene to just murder everybody. That's where like my wife would be like, to the pig stuff. But by the end, I think she's going to be so invested that she'll be like, here we go, kill them all, Like, and it's little things like that, like the dog and what he's doing to the farm and then like the suitors and the way they're talking to the beggar, like he gives them a chance to like treat them with kindness and they don't. And it's like, after so many things by the end with the cloak on, I was like, he's like a Jedi. I'm like, go kill everybody now.
Oh man. And like the Argus moment, like him seeing Odysseus and then immediately dying is straight out of the poem, and it's, you know, one of the really famous moments, and the way that was handled and the way that is what clues in Telemachus, and the way Tom Holland executes that scene, and there are so many, like there are times where I see so much of RDJ in Tom Holland, which makes sense because, you know, I think he's been something of a mentor to him over the years. And he brought together, I mean, that whole third act is just this incredibly satisfying thing. And the ending is really entirely of Nolan's creation, and I thought was one of the most beautiful pieces. I mean, the ending in terms of him reframing the whole thing to Penelope that we've talked about, but also
does he die in the book?
No, he doesn't die. He just
I wondered if that was one of the things he tweaked. Like that he instead like rides off into the sunset to go honor his men, right? Like he's changed person.
Yeah, and I thought he was just going to die in the movie, and that was going to be kind of, you know, the poem. Again, I think somewhat famously doesn't really have much of an ending. It's just kind of like he defeats all the suitors and then he's back and it's kind of like, okay, here we are. And then the poem's
over. Yeah, but
you kind of get
what you want here, which is always a recipe for success for Kyle. You get what you want. He kills everybody and then he gets the moment with his son, and then he makes his son king, who's because he's now grown, right. And now he's going with his wife. He doesn't die. If he had died after she waited 20 years, I was like, no.
I know.
Like, La La Land style, please.
I thought No, it's so great because it gives everybody a really compelling, their own compelling arc, at least in terms of the main characters there, where you have Penelope getting what she initially told Odysseus he should do whenever they came to recruit him for the war. He's finally listening to her and kind of realizing that probably on some level he should have listened to her in the first place because of all that's now befallen, not just his own people, but Troy and Agamemnon and everybody else. And then Telemachus, the whole thing is he wants to be someone that's taken seriously and seen as adult and worthy of being king. And you keep getting the sense that he's not. Like he is, it's not just that people are telling him he isn't, you can just tell that he's not ready. And then you see him reach that moment. And I loved the way that when you see him all decked out in the armor and everything at the end, like that feels like the right move for him. But I think most importantly, it feels like the right move for Odysseus because he is relinquishing the whole warrior mantle for good now. It was this sort of like, I have to do this one more time to basically correct something that I probably caused by leaving and by being gone so long and all of this. I've basically let my whole country go to ruin. So I'm going to set things right, and then I'm done, and I'm going to leave with Penelope and not seek out anything like that anymore. It's
no doubt
such the way all of that comes together.
I also loved everything about Penelope.
Yeah.
I thought Anne Hathaway was amazing, and I am not the biggest Anne Hathaway fan. I like Anne Hathaway. I don't worship Anne Hathaway.
Right.
I thought she turned in an incredible performance. That character, I know nothing about it from the book, but it was such a unique character because there's a lot of gray area in that character. She loves Odysseus truly. And then it's really remarkable and commendable that she actually holds out for 20 years, waiting for him to come back for his love, not take another suitor, et cetera.
Right.
Even though that would be the easier thing to do. But then there are parts of it where she's like, she freaked out on Tom Holland about, I'm the queen, basically. Like, this is my throne too. And there was a lot of nuance there. She's hurt when she finally gets to talk to Odysseus, but then loves seeing him. And then I love the ending that she ultimately lays that down, like that whole life of like queen, my throne, suitors, castle, this thing I'm painting on canvas, all of that gets kind of set aside to go back with Odysseus on a journey, which was the original journey they set on, 20 years ago, they talked about doing, traveling into the sunset. I thought it was a great character, and I thought she really acted it well.
Yeah, I thought, in general, there were a couple of casting things that I was not totally sure on. I honestly wasn't totally sold on having Charlize Theron in the movie whenever I saw her casting. I thought she did a great job.
She did. For sure.
Just in general, I felt like that was a win. And we've talked about this as a given, but Ludwig's score is...
See, that's interesting to me. We got to talk about this. We can close with this if you want to.
Yeah.
I thought it was good, not great. I thought the sound design was unbelievable. The sound design.
Yeah.
I can't remember... Like, to me, Oppenheimer blows this out of the water with the music of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think Oppenheimer may be my favorite, overall film score of all time, not getting into kind of John Williams themes and stuff. But, yeah, I think...
He has the one weird, Mellotron-sounding, pivotal thing he comes back to. It's, out of tune a little bit.
Yeah.
But in general, I did not walk away going, wow, what a score, which is, again, it's still good. I'm not ripping on it. I'm just saying of all the elements of the film, that to me was not the standout.
No, I think it's also, it's different from Oppenheimer in that I think that's a score that really stands on its own it's crucial to the movie. I mean, I think what's I've been thinking about it because I Candace said The Odyssey might be her favorite Nolan movie ever, and I think a lot of people are reaching that conclusion. To me, I think Oppenheimer is probably going to hold my number one spot still, and then The Odyssey, and then maybe The Dark Knight. But I think the thing about Oppenheimer that's interesting is, whereas The Odyssey, it's all of it, you know, it's all of it all coming together in such this incredible way. Oppenheimer is 90% for me, the score and Cillian Murphy. Like, and those are things that everything else is great, by the way. I'm not belittling Florence Pugh or Emily Blunt or whatever, but I think that that's the thing that I want out of that movie whenever I'm rewatching it. And I listen to that score at least once a week, all the way through. The Odyssey, I don't think the score on its own will get that kind of listen from me.
That's
and to be clear, Black Panther doesn't either, right? And I love that score too. But I do think that in the context of the movie, it works pretty perfectly. Like the way he incorporates the thrum of the bow, I think.
Sound design. If right. Maybe that's where we're just, you know.
And I think part of it, it's hard for me to even separate some of that stuff out in my mind because it's so woven in. And that's what I was impressed with. Not that there was any one theme that you would have, like, can you hear the music in Oppenheimer? But I think the way it's, you know, it reminds me more of kind of what we were talking about with some of the, you know, some of the Zimmer stuff where
there's
not always a melody that I come away with, but he infuses the whole thing.
I think it's a very apt comparison. I think Zimmer still errs on the side of more melodic. I can walk away and go, oh, Zimmer did, you know, C sharp minor, A, E, B. And he built on that or whatever. Whereas Ludwig is always a little more pushing the boundary with sound design. Like, I'm going to use a weird instrument, time. But it's using all Greek instruments,
which is cool.
It's never as melodic. Even Killmonger's theme is an 808. Boom, 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 boom,
yeah.
Boom, boom. Right. I'm just saying, I love it. I'm just saying.
But you do have the dun, 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 dun. You know, like
it's
he a, does
it's
the.
A, it's, again, it's all, you know, we're picking nits here. I can right now sing themes from Interstellar, from Inception, from The Dark Knight. I could sing them right now. And I can't quite put my finger on the stuff from The Odyssey. In that way, I think it's a little more sound design-y what I'm saying.
No, I think that's probably fair. I want to spend more time with it because I've listened to it a bit on Spotify, but most of my experience with it has been in the context of the movie. But yeah, I think what I do appreciate is some of the same stuff that I really liked about what he brought to the Wakanda Forever score, which is him. It feels so Nolan. Like he seems so well suited to a Nolan filmmaking process, in that they are both so intense about the integrity of the entire experience. Like with him wanting to go and get all of these kind of Central American, South American instruments for Wakanda Forever, and then him wanting to try to capture instruments that he thinks would have been accurate to this part of the world and this time when the poem was being told, I think it's a really cool thing that he seems to bring to any project. And I think for a project like this, where there was such a focus on getting on location and all the stuff we've talked about, I think that stuff like that matters. But yeah, I would say it did not. I thought it was perfect for what they were doing. It did not immediately surpass something like Oppenheimer for me yet.
Well, I loved it. I think it's such an important movie. I would almost encourage anyone to go see it at this point because of how you started this episode. I think, you know, like Oppenheimer had a really powerful message, but because Oppenheimer is even more real, it's based on something we all know. There's inherently already some hurdles or like politics for people on will the message fully resonate with everybody by the end? Right. And there's going to be some, not pushback, but some people being like, okay, about certain things. I think that's the beauty of a story like The Odyssey and why I'm saying you should go see it is because it's not real, because it's based on a poem. I think this is one of the reasons I like not real things like science fiction.
Yeah.
Is you are then able to get these nuggets of truth woven into the story that you can take away. And again, going all the way back, like all the practical sets and how it feels and how it looks and how it sounds and how it's acted, everything and how it's written, everything is so good. But your takeaway is that I want to be a better human. And to me, that's really cool. And like he can hide that like a dog, you know, cover it in peanut butter and give the medicine, but he hides it amongst all these other things that are perfect. And because it's not real, I don't think any human's going to have a hurdle or an adverse reaction to that message.
Yeah, I mean,
and
it's
I love
like
that.
The,
so it's so important to me. Go see it. Go see the movie.
It's like the thing that I've probably said before, but it's like the J.R.R. Tolkien idea that if you have something that you want to say, the most effective way of doing that is to kind of sneak it in through the back door. Like don't come out and say this is the thing that this is about and kind of ring the gong. Give people a great story, and buried in that great story are these messages that you think are important or truths that you want to communicate. And I think that is what you can, I think that's what you can do in fantasy in general, but you don't have to do it in fantasy. And that's like, my point being, you can make a fantasy and not do that. I think that's often the stuff that feels forgettable. And I think that's why this will have the kind of staying power that we've talked about. And also, last thing, you're talking about people should go see it. You should also go see it because this is the first movie that's ever been made fully on IMAX, which means for people that don't know, it's basically shot in almost a square. And obviously our normal TV screens are rectangles, and that's why you can't have the IMAX stuff equate perfectly. Although I don't know, maybe Nolan's working on some way to make the Blu-ray or streaming version work more. But as it stands, it looks like if you don't go see this in theaters and in specifically 70 millimeter IMAX or the biggest screen that you have access to, you actually may not ever get the opportunity to see the movie that he shot, which is kind of crazy.
No doubt. Greg posted a list online of the top 10 largest theaters in the country. And I was delighted to see Opry Mills sitting there at number 4. I thought it was the biggest theater in the country as far as it's the biggest one I've ever been to.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the Bullock is maybe on there too in Austin, or at least high-ish up, but it's
maybe. Wasn't looking for it.
We don't have a 70 millimeter theater, which drives me crazy. It used to be one, but it does at least because of that, the screen is sized for that. So it's a digital IMAX, but it is at least at the ratio of a 70 millimeter IMAX. So I think it's what we'll have to take.
All right. We loved it. Let's freaking go plus. 2 thumbs up. Go see it. What a summer. What a summer. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Back here on Screensaver on Friends from Work.